From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. We have a special hour of Radio Boston today. Conversations with writers who challenged us. Northampton's Ocean Vuong and his unique approach to writing, which won him a Genius Award.
I saw this book like a flower. Every petal is its own thing, but it requires all of the petals blooming in unison to create a rose.
Kwame Alexander's tribute to our complicated past.
You know, like Langston Hughes said in his poem, I too sing America. Like, we forget that. And this poem is a love letter to Black America, but it's a love letter to America to remind us who we are.
Reginald Dwayne Betts' poetry from prison.
It might be better put to say the moment poetry discovered me.
And Kristen Arnett, who made us rethink our home state.
There is a lot of weird Florida. Florida's very interesting. But Florida's also so much broader than that. So in writing this book, it was a sensory experience.
That's all coming up next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We have a certified genius coming up, but first, we hope you had a great Thanksgiving with your loved ones. And today, whether you're running around to shop for friends and family or sitting at home contemplating maybe some more mashed potatoes, if you're like me, you're also reflecting on the year as it races to the finish. The challenges, the joys, and maybe the books that have helped us process it all. So we have a special hour of Radio Boston for you. Conversations with authors that made us rethink things, from what a novel is to who we are as a nation. Let's start with a writer who made a big impact on many this year, Ocean Vuong. He lives in Northampton and teaches at UMass Amherst. This year, at 30 years old, he won a MacArthur Genius Award and released his first novel, On Earth, We're Briefly Gorgeous. The book is based in part on Vuong's experience growing up in Hartford, Connecticut. His family arrived as refugees in the 1990s from Vietnam. His mother had lived through the war. Back in June, we spoke with Vuong about weaving his family's own history into a fictional work.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
It is a pleasure to have you. Ocean, the book is a letter that a young boy named Little Dog writes to his illiterate mother. The family live in Hartford, Connecticut. They're refugees from the Vietnam War. Where did you get this idea, a letter to a mother, your mother, it seems, who will never read it because she can't?
Yeah, it seemed almost comically futile, the project. Why write a letter, and at that, a 240-page letter, to someone who will never receive it? But I think the very futility of it was what excited me as a writer, because when the recipient is not promised, the pressure now falls on language itself. And I think one could argue that language, particularly the English language, is another character in this book. When the project of communication fails or falters, the question then is, does language matter? And it was ultimately the experiment of the book to venture into American life with language and see where it takes us and where it fails us, which it often does.
I will say, though, as a reader and listening to you say that, if you had posed that question to me as I closed the book when I finished it, I would have said, well, clearly this book shows that language absolutely matters.
Yes.
And that it can stand on its own to tell a story.
Yes, yes. I feel that way as a writer, as a professor of English. But I think one of the pleasures of the book is that you get your chance to orchestrate the stakes. And for a reader entering this book, you start to see that the stakes are built up towards that reality. You know, I could stand in front of an audience and say, well, language matters, and that would be fine enough. But then folks would think, well, how? Why? And I guess the book is my attempt at asking how and why.
To that point, you have said about this book that you wanted to start with the truth and end with art.
Yes.
That feels like the trajectory that you're talking about. Tell our listeners, what do you mean by that?
It was an exciting moment, I think, in responding and participating in the American lineage of the autobiography. That lineage begins with Herman Melville and Moby Dick, right in Nantucket. You know, people rarely write of Moby Dick as an autobiographical book, but it is. Herman lived that life. And so I think I'm participating in a lineage that I was dropped into, and a lineage, an American lineage that I'm inspired by. where the I, the historical I, is malleable. It can be tested and transformed through fiction and the imagination. And it's no wonder that Melville's contemporary was Walt Whitman, who says, "Do I contradict myself? Very well, then I contradict myself. I contain multitudes." And that idea of multitudinous was so vital to American life. And now, in the hands of myself, a queer Asian American writer, the idea of a multiplicity towards thinking and being in this country is incredibly inspiring and enriching. And I think to start with who we are, the truth gets us in the room, and it's up to us to decorate it on our own terms. And that's art.
There are so many things I want to unpack from what you just said. Let me just hit two of them. The first, you talked about the American lineage of the autobiography. And it's clear that this book is at least semi-autobiographical, but it is a novel. So why is it a novel? Why did you not write pure autobiography?
Agency as an artist is very important for me. And going back to the lineage, you know, we began, the American inspiration is that one can create one's mythology for oneself. You know, this is the dream. This is the dream of Western expansion. And when it comes to policy on the ground, what became a dream ended up as violence and genocide and environmental collapse in our Western expansion with Manifest Destiny. But when it came to literature, where the power in the negotiation was always with language, it was incredibly potent space to reinvent oneself towards fiction. And I think what inspired me was that when you write a novel that's based on life, what you're creating is the ghost before the flesh. Often we think of ghosts as what remains once the body leaves. But when you write a novel, you're writing a future, a reality and a world based on your life, but one you've never really lived, right? Never truly enacted down to the T. And that negotiation was incredibly powerful for me as an artist. And I wanted to blend the borders to say that American life is inspiring for art. We don't have to aim for timelessness. We can put CVS in there. We can put fentanyl and opioids in there because that's what we're dealing with. We can put Dunkin' Donuts in there because it becomes a time capsule and a map of thinking and feeling as a way of informing the imagination.
You said a couple of minutes ago, you talked about the multiplicity of life and of identity. One of the things that struck me in reading the book as a reader was the intersectionality in the book is so striking. You've got poverty meets immigration meets oxy and fentanyl and heroin meets, as you've noted, queer bodies meets the Vietnam War meets New England. Mm-hmm. In reading the book, it seems that it's to get the full power of your art, to use your term. You have to be able to embrace and sort of take in all of those identities at once. Yeah. But is this also a story where one could come to it from one of those places? You know, someone, a Vietnamese immigrant, or someone who's queer, or someone who's experienced poverty in the Northeast. Do you have to take it all in at once, or can you appreciate the art taking in a piece of it at a time?
Yeah, I think that's the joy of the reader's participation. It's up to them. I would say that for me, the novel in the Western tradition asks of us to have a linear plot, one that uses conflict to progress the story. Conflict-driven plot becomes almost its own protagonist, where people are fed into the wood chipper of plot and they become props. And I think for me, it was more important to surrender or even refuse plot in order to gain people. I think I didn't want to compromise one label over another because American life is that complicated and that rich. And instead of a linear plot, I saw this book like a flower. Every petal is its own thing, but it requires all of the petals blooming in unison to create a rose. And I think that's what American life is.
You, in this book, you have these moments often juxtaposed of horrifying abuse or terror or tragedy, and then intimacy and joy and beauty. Are those petals on the flower, to use your metaphor, that have to coexist? Do they have to be side by side like that to fully appreciate them?
Yeah, proximity creates tension. And also, I wanted to enact, you know, mental illness and schizophrenia, which a lot of these women in this novel negotiate. It's almost like switching channels on a TV. And at some times that could be horrific, but at times that could be quite beautiful. That when a moment gets really intense, the TV switches or the pedal reveals itself, and now you're in a different, more merciful, sweet and tender balm. And that's what it's like. You know, there's no total immersion. It's just a constant flickering of hardness and beauty.
Tell us more about the women in this book. They loom so large and powerfully in the main character, Little Dog's life. Tell us about them.
I wanted to really take the advantage of the first-person narrative in the way Ishmael saw Ahab in Moby Dick, Nick Carraway saw Gatsby, in Junior saw Oscar Wilde in Junior Diaz. I felt that there's an opportunity to take the eye and turn it into a searchlight. And for me, it was to amplify the lives of these women. Often, it is the men who create the wars, and it's the women who clean it up. And they clean it up emotionally, psychically. They clean it up physically. They heal these broken bodies. And I think for me, the question was, at what cost? I didn't want to romanticize them into women warriors or heroes. I wanted to see, this is the cost when women lay their bodies on the line to recuperate entire families after war. The cost is their own mental health, is their own joy. And then the question for me is, how do they find joy? How do they find it on their own terms? And it's not a spoiler that, for me, one of the proudest moments is that the book ends on the laughter of an Asian American woman.
Why does that make you feel so proud?
I don't think I've seen it before. You know, and that for a book full of language, for it to end on wordless joy, to me seems like such a feat to attempt.
That's Ocean Vuong. We spoke with him in June. He's a writer who teaches at UMass Amherst and won a MacArthur Genius Award this year. His novel, On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous, was dedicated to his mother, who passed away this month from cancer. She was 51 years old. On Instagram, Vuong wrote briefly of her passing and posted a photo of a lecture that they attended together. I wanted to honor her, along with all working-class mothers who put their heads down through decades of backbreaking work so their children can put their heads up. Author Kwame Alexander's latest work was also inspired by his family and is about the importance of knowing where you came from. Back in April, he told us about a poem that he first wrote for his newborn daughter back in 2008.
So my daughter was born in 2008, a couple of months before we elected Obama. And I thought, how cool is it that my daughter will know her first president as a black man? You know, and that would be her default. And I wanted to write something to show her the journey of how we got to this point in our country, where we came from, sort of the challenges and the triumphs, the woes and the wonder. And so I wrote this poem. I called it An American Poem.
This year, that poem was published as a children's book. It's called The Undefeated, and he calls it a love letter to Black America. It's illustrated with paintings of black people who have had a significant impact on American history, like Jesse Owens, Ella Fitzgerald, and Michael Brown, the 18-year-old man killed by police in Ferguson, Missouri. He spoke with WBUR's Callum Borchers in April about giving an American poem a whole new life. That process started in 2016, 8 years after he first wrote an American poem.
Fast forward about 8 years, and Kevin Merida at ESPN was starting a website called theundefeated.com. And it was to explore the intersection of race, culture, and sports. And he said, Kwame, we want you to write a poem to launch it. And I remembered An American Poem and sort of pulled it back out, retooled it, reworked it, and came up with this piece that now became this book, The Undefeated.
And there's a lot of powerful imagery in the video. You've recorded a spoken word version of the poem for The Undefeated website.
Right.
But we also can't talk about this book without talking about the beautiful illustrations by Kadir Nelson that also are in the physical book that we have in front of us now. Do you have a favorite illustration in there?
My favorite page is probably going to be that third page in the book, and I don't want to spoil it. You know, I'm a storyteller.
Come on.
Well, I'll put it to you like this.
It's the blank page, right? I mean, I'm giving away a little bit here, but what's the significance of that?
Well, we don't want to say what it is because we don't want to spoil it for people.
All right.
But let's say it were a blank page.
Hypothetically.
This is for the ones who survived America by any means necessary and the ones who didn't. And so it's that page. And I remember my editor saying, well, maybe we want some doves on that page. And I was like, no, we don't. We need the silence. We need to sit with that pain. We need to sit with that. But my favorite illustration is probably going to be the Massachusetts 54th, like the soldier, the black soldier in the
civil fight. Uniform.
In uniform.
Yeah.
Like that really spoke to me because I dedicated the book to my great-great-grandfather, March Corper, who fought in the Civil War.
Wow. I'll tell you, the image that really made me stop is the one that is different from all the rest. So this is the first of three pages that repeat the line, "This is for the unspeakable." And the accompanying illustration I would describe almost as a tessellation of black bodies crammed together as if on a slave ship, right? And the figures are basically faceless or at least indistinguishable, which to me conveys dehumanization in the slave trade. And Nelson, your illustrator, spoke with NPR's All Things Considered this week about the painting. Let's take a listen.
The subject matter is very difficult. It's not pretty. So even though I'm an artist and I try to create images that are you know, visually pleasing, it was important that this subject be portrayed in the way that it I think it should be. It's striking, it's unsettling, but and it also gives you pause, like, well, this really happened.
So when you wrote that line, Kwame, "This is for the unspeakable," does this image by Kadir Nelson capture what you had in your mind?
Absolutely. At the same time, it was not necessarily in my mind when I wrote those lines three times. This is for the unspeakable. This is for the unspeakable. This is for the unspeakable. And I didn't give Kadir any guidance. But he took those lines and sort of, you know, identified those moments in our history that needed that silence, that bring us to pause, that make us, you know, sort of remember and reflect on our tragic past. And wow, like he chose, you know, the slave ships on the Middle Passage. He chose the four black girls who were in the church in Alabama.
Right.
He chose memorial to Black Lives Matters victims. And I think that's pretty incredible because I tell people all the time that, yeah, I wrote the poem. There's a story in the words, but Kadir created a whole nother story with his illustrations.
And that each of those three is unspeakable in its own way.
Exactly.
You see that progression. I'm hoping, Kwame, that you'll read a little bit of your book for us. This is beginning on the page that has the large portrait of Martin Luther King Jr. and then continuing to the next page, which has this collage of great athletes.
"This is for the unlimited, unstoppable ones. The dreamers and the doers who swim across the big sea of our imagination and show us the majestic shores of the promised land. The Wilma Rudolphs, the Jesse Owenses, the Muhammad Ali's, the Althea Gibsons, the Jordans and the LeBrons, the Serenas and the Cheryls, the Reese Whitleys and the Undiscovered. This is for the unbelievable, the we real cool ones. This is for the unbending, the black as the night is beautiful ones. This is for the underdogs and the uncertain, the unspoken but no longer untitled."
You're giving me chills. I wish people could see you performing this in front of me right now in your American flag scarf to get the full effect.
Yeah, yeah. You know, like Langston Hughes said in his poem, "I too sing America." Like we forget that. And this poem is a love letter to Black America, but it's a love letter to America to remind us who we are.
Well, tell me a little bit about the significance of referencing Langston Hughes there. So for anybody who might have missed it, you know, we obviously have the portrait of Martin Luther King Jr. in there, and you're sort of quoting or at least paraphrasing him there. But there's also references to Langston Hughes in there. What are the significance of those two figures, and perhaps it's their writing or their oratorical style that influences the way you wrote this poem?
Well, Langston Hughes was sort of an inspirer for so many writers and artists. In particular, me. Like, Langston was the guy. When I decided I was going to be a writer, I sort of patterned my life after him. When Langston's first book came out in 1926, The Weary Blues, He got in a car. He started in Harlem. He drove from Harlem to Daytona Beach with a friend who was an artist. And they sold poems. They sold artwork. They went to churches, theaters, community centers. And what am I doing right now? I'm on a 25-city book tour. Now, I'm not in a car. I'm on a tour bus. But the idea that I tried to pattern my life after this guy who was sort of the Black Bard of Harlem, you know, who sort of was unapologetically writing about the nuances and the beauty and the tragedy of Black life. Martin Luther King was that for all of us. He was the guy who sort of inspired a country to be better, to do better. And he gave us sort of that moral compass, that map to becoming more human. And I thought, what better way to pay tribute to than to pay tribute to Martin Luther King and Langston Hughes? And so I talk about The Big C, Langston Hughes' autobiography. A quote, "The night is beautiful." That's from a Langston Hughes poem, "My People." And of course, you know, the dreamers. Who are the dreamers? When we think of the dream, we think of Martin Luther King.
But it's also in Let America Be America Again, right? The famous Langston Hughes poem as well. So there you go.
There you go.
And you mentioned Jordan and LeBron back to back in the passage that you read as well. And I wanted to ask you about that, right? Because okay, so you know, each is the greatest player of his generation. But as activists, they're very different, Kwame, right? I mean, LeBron's very outspoken, while Jordan was famously apolitical during his playing days, which, you know, drew some criticism from Arthur Ashe and others. So how were you thinking about those similarities and differences when you put them back to back?
Hey, look. You know, LeBron is doing something off the court that no other athlete today has embraced. He's embracing this idea of trying to change the world, like starting a school, paying for kids to go to college, you know, so with his foundation. So he's actively involved. The mere fact that Jordan was poetry in motion was the greatest player to play the game is a statement in and of itself, because little Black boys and little Black girls got to see him excel on the court. Like, there's something to being a role model. And I think he was a role model as an athlete. I think LeBron is a mind model. I think there's space and room for both of them, for all of us.
You know, we mentioned at the top that you now have your own imprint called Versify, and I have to ask you about that because it's just great power, great responsibility, as the saying goes, that you have now, Kwame, right? I mean, I've read that to get your first novel in verse published, The Crossover, was a real slog, that you were rejected by 22 different publishers before Houghton picked it up. And so now you have the chance to give a platform to authors who, like you, not too long ago, were undiscovered. So what do you want to accomplish?
Well, that's why I want to do this, because I don't want authors who have a voice, who have something to say, who have a vision, who are thinking outside the box. I don't want them not to have those opportunities. I don't want them to have to go through those 22 rejections like I did, you know? And so I want to be the guy to give more Kwamis an opportunity. I like to think that what we're trying to do, I get asked all the time, what's our mission? I like to think that my dad was a PhD, a publisher. He was a college professor. He made me read his college dissertations at age 11. That was horrible for a kid, right?
I can't imagine.
What kid wants to do that? My dad made me read Wretched of the Earth by Frantz Fanon at age 12. Like, I did not like books because
I was
of
reading
that.
The Hardy Boys, Kwame.
Yeah. So I had this. My mother was reciting poetry by Langston Hughes and singing songs. I think I had that intelligence and that entertainment. With Versify, I'm trying to create intelligent entertainment.
That's Kwame Alexander, winner of the Newbery Medal for the most distinguished contribution to American literature for children. He spoke with WBUR's Callum Borchers about his book, The Undefeated, back in April. Stay with us for a special hour of Radio Boston. Coming up, Reginald Dwayne Betts, who says he first discovered poetry while incarcerated.
I was in solitary confinement for, I guess, maybe the second or third time. And somebody just slid this anthology, this poetry anthology to me. It was Dudley Randall's Black Poets. And it sort of profoundly changed my life.
I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We're taking this hour to think about the year as it rushes to a close by returning to conversations we've had with writers who made us stop and reflect. We just heard from Kwame Alexander about writing and illustrating poems for children. We also spoke with a poet this year who discovered poetry in an unusual place, prison. He named his collection Felon. Reginald Dwayne Betts was convicted for using a pistol to carjack a man when Betts was 16 years old. He served more than 8 years in an adult prison, including months in solitary confinement. After he was released, Betts went on to earn multiple degrees, including one from Yale Law School. President Obama appointed him to the Coordinating Council of the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention. His writing has won numerous awards, including a National Magazine Award in 2018. Betts now lives in New Haven. He spoke with us in October about poetry and prison.
It might be better put to say the moment poetry discovered me, but I was in solitary confinement for, I guess, maybe the second or third time. And in the hole, you couldn't request books, and so we had sort of a system in which we just passed each other the books that we had. We passed it on. So if somebody shouted, "Somebody have a book," and they wouldn't name a specific kind of book, they just asked for a book. And whoever was closest to them that would have a book, they would just send it to them. So I called for a book, and I had been there for maybe 3 or 4 months, and I asked for a book, and somebody just slid this anthology, this poetry anthology to me. It was Dudley Randall's Black Poets, and it sort of profoundly changed my life, introduced me to the poetry of Etheridge Knight, Lucille Clifton, Nikki Giovanni, but sort of more importantly, the poems helped me see that in a space of 14 lines or 20 lines or 30 lines, you could communicate what people tried to say in a whole novel, you know, in a whole 30-page essay, 15-page essay. And that I like the idea that in a minute and a half, I could try to tell everybody what mattered for that moment.
So when did you first try it? Do you remember when you wrote your first poem?
Yeah, it would have been the same night. You know, like I read the book, it would have been, I read for Freckleface Gerald, you know, Etheridge Knight had did time in prison. And so part of Becoming Anything is seeing somebody who you could see your own reflection in doing it. And Etheridge Knight has served time in prison, and he had became a poet, and he had became a published poet while incarcerated. And so that same night, I know that I scribbled something.
This new collection of poetry, it's about the emotional trauma of prison. It is greatly varied in the length of the poems and the style of the poems, but there is a strong voice that, you know, I think penetrates all the way through. You talk about the wounds that people who are incarcerated carry with them even when they're out. I'd love to ask you to read one of the poems from the book. It's one of four poems that are called Essay on Reentry. Would you read that for us?
Definitely. Essay on Reentry. At 2 a.m., without enough spirit spilling into my liver to know to keep my mouth shut, my youngest learned of years I spent inside a box. A spell, a kind of incantation I was under. Not whiskey, but history. I robbed a man. This, months before, my son would drop bucket after bucket on opposing players. The entire bedraggled bunch 5 and 6, and he leaping as if every layup erases something. That's how I saw it. My screaming, coaching, sweating presence recompensed for the pen. My father ain't never seen me play ball as part of this. My oldest son knew, told of my crimes by a stranger. Tell me we aren't running towards failure is what I want to ask my sons. But it is 2 a.m. The oldest has gone off to dream in the comfort of his room. The youngest, despite him seeming more lucid than me, just reflects cartoons back from his eyes. So when he tells me, "Daddy, it's okay," I know what's happening is some scraggling angel, lost from his pack, finding a way to fulfill his duty, lending words to this kid who crawls into my arms, wanting more than stories of my prison. The sleep that he fought while I held court at a bar where men who knew that when the drinking was done, the drinking wouldn't make the stories we brought home any easier to tell.
Thank you. If I can ask, you have 2 sons, is that right?
Yes.
How do you talk to your sons about prison?
I think I talk to him. I mean, I've learned that I talk to him the way we have to talk to our children about anything. I'm honest. I'm upright. It's complicated. Sometimes I'm sad. I feel like sometimes we aren't able to have this wide range of emotions. We aren't able to tap into what it means to have regrets. And we talk to our children as if we have all of the answers. And sometimes I talk to them and I find myself just admitting that I don't have enough of the answers, let alone all of the answers.
Does it bother you to admit that?
Maybe it did before, but I think, I know one of the things that learning to be a parent has been meant for me is learning when whatever I was, whatever I am, is not this body of perfection that my children need. You know, it's just me. And you get that when your child is up at, 2 a.m. and you're frustrated and you just don't know what to do to keep them from crying. And you call in those days because you figured it out. You know, I figured it out then when I didn't have enough, when I hadn't done it before, when I couldn't call on, a family member to come help, when, my wife might have been asleep and she needed to sleep, or when I might have been asleep because I needed to sleep and she had to figure it out. You know, you learn that you are enough, even if that enough isn't everything.
I can't imagine a parent in the world listening to this who doesn't profoundly identify with what you just said. I noted that there are several poems in the book with that same title, Essay on Reentry. Why did you do that, and what were you working towards with four different poems all with that same title?
You know, I think we sort of circumscribe what it means to be incarcerated in such a way that we imagine that the felon is some unique person, that the person who has a criminal conviction is some unique person. And by doing that, it makes it far easier to discriminate against them. But by titling a bunch of poems, Essay on Reentry, I was trying to cover the sort of expansiveness of the experience. I think that people should be able to relate to the poem I just read, even if it isn't prison that they're telling their child about. It could be anything. It could be anything. And you asking your child to give you something that children just aren't required to give us, which is solace, which is like providing the answers that we need from them when sometimes they just need a hug. And then there's other poems that sort of Essay on Reentry poems that talk about what it means to have reconnected with somebody who the speaker have victimized, right? It means, what does it mean to talk to a person who you hurt and have them remind you of that hurt in a way that is challenging to you? It's poems about the collateral consequences. And so the point is that it's just not one version of coming home. The Essay on Reentry is trying to remind people that it's multiple iterations of what it means to come home. And they just, sadly, never stop. You know, I'll probably be 50, 60 years old, still contemplating what it means to be free.
Duane, a minute ago you used the word challenging. There are four other poems in the book that you call redacted or redaction poems. And I found them incredibly challenging. They appear on the page. They look like a redacted legal document on the page of the book with big black lines blocking out much of the text. Can you tell me a little bit about how you got the idea of these redaction poems?
I should say you are absolutely correct. They are redacted legal documents.
So those are real legal documents.
Yeah, those are real legal documents.
That was one of the things I was wondering when I read them.
Are you a lawyer?
No, I'm not, but they look like stuff out of Ferguson, out of the Ferguson report.
Yeah, so you sound like a lawyer right now.
Which
everybody listening will say, oh, man, all I need to do is say that to sound like a lawyer. But so what happened was it's an organization called the Civil Rights Corps. And they filed lawsuits against, like, the city of Montgomery, the city of Ferguson, and the city of Houston. And those lawsuits were because those cities were having practices in which they incarcerated people for their inability to pay bail or to pay small fines. But the thing is, if you want to read one of these civil suits, and the civil suit is at bottom the way a citizen can say, listen, I'm being mistreated by the system, court system, do something to stop me from being mistreated. These lawsuits are 70 pages long. They're filled with all kind of complicated minutiae, things about jurisdiction, all references to other law cases, and nobody is really going to read that 70-page lawsuit. But this, to me, the lawsuit itself is like one of the sort of symbols of democracy. It is our way to have voice in a system that's supposed to correct error. But what does it mean if nobody could understand the way that the system does that? What does it mean if nobody will read one of these complaints? So what I wanted to do was turn a 70-page complaint into a 4-page poem, a 5-page poem, a 10-page poem. And a redaction, instead of being redacting the things that are supposed to be confidential, above our pay grade. I wanted to say, no, I'm redacting what's superfluous. And so when that 70-page poem, that 70-page legal brief, that 70-page complaint becomes a 4-page poem, I'm saying that this is the heart of it. This is what actually matters.
We only have about 2 minutes left, but I really want listeners to hear this. Could you read just the first section of In Alabama for us?
In Alabama versus the city of Montgomery. The plaintiffs, impoverished, jailed by the city, unable to pay traffic tickets, pay or sit in jail. $50 per day. Plaintiffs unable to pay, each sent to jail. Told they could work off debts, $25 per day, cleaning the city, scrubbing feces and blood from jail floors.
What's striking is that the story isn't what's behind the black lines. The story is what's left after you use the black lines.
Yeah, you know, it's astonishing that that these things were going on when you read the poem. Somebody asked me if I made this up. And these lawsuits, they were all won. You know, the judge in these suits found that the practice were unconstitutional. So these were actually real cases in which the plaintiffs, the people who said that they were harmed, they won. And so when people say, I can't believe that this is happening, what I ask myself is how much of what happens in the criminal justice system happens under our names and we are fundamentally unaware of.
Dwayne, we've got about a minute left. These poems cost a person in reading them. What does it cost you to write your poetry?
Oh, man, I got a minute.
Sorry.
I don't know. I think I know every week I get phone calls from people doing life in prison. So I'm not sure what it costs me, but I know what it costs them to still be serving out their prison sentences. And I hope some of the poetry and some of the advocacy and some of the legal work I do could get somebody free.
Dwayne Betts is an award-winning writer and poet. We spoke with him about his collection of poetry, Felon, this past October. Stay with us. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Back to this special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We're taking today to reflect on the year as it passes with the help of authors who made us rethink ourselves. So far, we've heard from a novelist about living the American dream and the Vietnamese-American mother who made it possible, and from two poets, one writing about America for children and another about discovering poetry in prison. Writer Kristen Arnett is fascinated with how we write about place. And in her case, that place is Central Florida, which she calls home. She's a librarian, a Twitter humorist, and her first novel, Mostly Dead Things, is about a lesbian taxidermist. Here's how she explained the plot to us in August.
The elevator pitch, yes. Okay, so lesbian taxidermist in Central Florida takes over her family's taxidermy business after her father commits suicide in the taxidermy shop.
Okay, so I have to tell you, this is how brilliant that was, because the producer wrote a synopsis. I've read the book, but yeah. Wrote a synopsis. I have to read it to you. Lesbian taxidermist in Florida taking over shop for her father who shot himself on the workday.
Yeah!
So clearly the subject matter of the book comes across.
Yeah.
but that is a very specific premise.
Yes.
Oh my goodness. So how did you get to that specific idea?
Yeah. I knew a couple things about writing this book. I knew that I wanted it to be a book about grief and loss. I knew I wanted it to be about Florida, specifically the Central Florida that I've experienced. I'm third generation Central Floridian. Mm-hmm. And then I wanted to be able to look at those kind of themes with something that would enable me to take hold of the physical and the tactile. So that's very much taxidermy, right? So like taxidermy carries a lot of the weight of this book. It allows like people to process memory and nostalgia, because this is a book a lot about memory and nostalgia in this way that taxidermy helps with, right? Because taxidermy is memory. Taxidermy is these very specifically posed memories. So I knew I wanted something that I'd be able to be like very physical and tactile with and be able to get into like kind of the gross nitty gritty, also like dealing with how people perceive Florida, which is sometimes in this way that they think of as tacky.
Mm-hmm.
And taxidermy just carried a lot of that weight for me. I did a ton of research. I'm also a librarian, so yeah.
There you go. And I was going to ask you about that because there was so much acute and specific detail about taxidermy that, by the way, wasn't boring, and who knew that was possible, that I found myself thinking, okay, so is she descended from taxidermists? I mean, how does she? Did you really just go out there and say, I'm going to learn taxidermy?
I did. The genesis of this book, I was looking at a lot of really bad taxidermy on the internet just for fun.
What is bad taxidermy?
Okay, so like if someone makes taxidermy and then like the eyes are crossed or just
Okay.
And there's a lot of it. And to me, it was like specifically very funny because it looks funny, right? But it's also like something someone spent hours on and it winds up looking like completely demonic sometimes. So I was like, oh, this is very interesting to me as a person who like makes arts and crafts myself too, or grew up in this kind of place where it's like domestic arts mm-hmm. are kind of connected with taxidermy because it's a lot of sewing, it's a lot of making. So I don't know, I spent a ton of time researching in books, YouTube videos, which I keep joking around about this, but maybe it's not a joke that maybe I'm on some government watch list now. Like I was like Googling like how to dissolve flesh and I'm like, that's not normal.
No.
Yeah. But it was a lot of like research work and then a lot of chat and web forums where I wanted to see like people who actually like produce this kind of art, like where they talked with each other for like tips and tricks, how they talked specifically with each other, like the language they use, because I wanted it to sound very authentic in the mm-hmm. book when I was talking about the process and procedures. So I did. I spent a ton of time up front. And anytime in the book that there's an animal that gets taxidermied, I specifically looked up, like, what does it look like to actually be hands-on with this kind of process?
All right, let's talk about the characters mm-hmm. for a minute. And actually, I want to start with the non-human character in the book, which is Florida,
yes.
I think. You know, you talk about, I think you said third generation, mm-hmm. Central Florida. Florida plays a central role, the character of it, as you said, sort of people's perceptions. I thought maybe you could start off by reading a passage. It's the narrator describing the ways in which her Central Florida town is changing around her.
Yeah.
Would you mind reading that for us?
Of course, sure. Newcomers renovated the beat-up sections of the downtown area, painting walls and repaving streets with brick until everyone's tires bounced at speeds over 15 miles per hour. It wasn't new to me. It was what Central Floridians did. Pave over everything so they could forget what had been there before. Theme parks and chain restaurants were built over homes and libraries. Banks took the place of family-owned businesses. There were highways built over historic areas, places where you wouldn't know something had ever happened unless a person told you or you read about it in a book. No one ever seemed to remember what came before. A kind of local amnesia, my father called it.
What did you want to convey about Florida in this book?
To me, very specifically, I wanted to put across the very physical nature of what it feels like to live in that space. Because there are these preconceived ideas about what Florida is, right? There's Florida Man or Weird Florida. There's all these things in the news that people associate with Florida. And they're true. Like, those things happen there. There is a lot of Weird Florida. Florida's very interesting. But Florida is also so much broader than that, specifically Central Florida. So in writing this book, I was very much tasking myself with making it so it was a sensory experience. Anything I wrote, I wanted it to be like, what does it look like? But okay. But also, like, what does it sound like at night when you hear the cicada kind of scree? Like, what does it smell like when you smell that kind of mildewy algae lake water? Like, or a hose that's like running outside of a house that's been hot, that kind of rubbery smell. Like, what does it taste like in the air? Like, what does it feel like when like the air in Florida is like touching you? Because that's what it's like to live there. It's like a tactile sensation of the air almost pressing on you like hands.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, if I can get across this like physical sensation of living there, then maybe I'm going to be able to get across like what what I see, like the lens of my personal experience of living there.
Well, I mean, the descriptions that you just gave, it was like the studio melted away and I was sitting in this hot backyard and I could smell the hose and the cicadas were making. I mean, it was very vivid. Mm-hmm. We talk to a lot of authors here who are New England authors and
right.
who talk about the ways that New England looms large in their writing. I think, you know, you're in town. Mm-hmm. How would you compare and contrast a writer's characterization of New England with what you've done with Central Florida?
Yeah, well, I think, right, like we're all working against stereotypes. I was thinking that when I even got in here, because I was trying to think on like, what are stereotypes that people like write into New England, right? Like people with these heavy accents or mm-hmm. people who behave a certain way, even how traffic functions like in Boston. I was like, these are things I've definitely like read about as these kind of tropes. And that's not necessarily how place functions because place is so broad and people are so different. I think it's so hard to write about place because a lot of times, especially if you're from there, it's not just writing about place, it's writing about home. And writing about home is like very difficult, right? It's a love-hate relationship. And so it's maybe writing into like the things that you love about place and are trying to like uncover for people. But then also the things that like, yeah, this stereotype holds a little bit true. But let me write into
it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, let me uncover it a little bit and let's talk about it a little more so we can open it up. Like, the conversation is the thing I'm interested in, I guess.
You tweet a lot.
Yes.
You're very funny on Twitter and you're very present on Twitter. You actually tweet a lot about being gay.
Mm-hmm.
Your lead character, Jessa, is gay.
Yes.
And I think many people, when they think about queer fiction, think about this kind of coming out narrative. But mm-hmm. this book is not that, which I loved about it.
Yes.
Your main character's sexuality is not treated as a moment, right? Mm-hmm. Or abnormal or the thing
yeah.
or disruptive. Was that intentional?
Very much so. Yeah, when I was saying earlier, like, oh, writing into the book, there were a couple things I knew. One of them is I wanted to write a very specific Florida. The other was I knew I did not want to write a coming out story. Coming out, too, is like, you said it yourself, it's like, it's a moment. It's this moment. It's this flash. I mean, to be fair, we often have to come out over and over again. But it's this, like, moment thing. And also, a lot of times associated with a very specific trauma of coming out. And I worry sometimes who the coming out narrative is being written for, like if it's being written for a gay audience or if it's being written for a straight audience. Mm. So it was very important to me to write in this, like, what does it look like to be like going through family issues and you happen to be gay? What does it look like to be like, oh, I have problems with intimacy and I happen to be gay? Oh, what does it look like? And I'm like kind of fighting with my brother and also my business is like failing and I have to deal with this kind of stuff. Oh, yeah. And I happen to be gay. Like, what does it look like? Just a day to day kind of lived experience. And that was the thing I wanted to write because that's the thing I want to read,
yeah.
I feel like.
In many articles and in blurbs about your book, you're described as a queer author.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to put tags and labels
yes.
As we describe authors.
Yes.
Is that a label you would use for yourself?
It's one I purposely use for myself.
So can tell more about that.
Yeah. I made a very purposeful choice several years ago to be like, as a writer who was starting to achieve some success, it felt necessary for me to put that in there. So it's like, I want to be a person who's able to kind of open the door for other people also to be able to write more queer work.
Mm-hmm.
And putting that in your bio and putting that in your work, because it is the work I write. The work I write is very queer. So putting it in my bio and having it be very upfront in who I am as a person, I think hopefully helps other people who want to be writing that same kind of fiction have it an easier time creating and marketing and publishing that work because it's had like maybe a small measure of success. And so it means that maybe theirs could too.
Kristen Arnett's first novel, Mostly Dead Things, is about love, loss, and the art of preserving dead animals. The New York Times calls the book a cabinet of wonders and says Arnett is an important new voice in the tradition of Florida writers like Zora Neale Hurston and Karen Russell. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're produced by Zoe Mitchell, Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.